North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Derek Dennis. Another shooting scare for former President Trump. Gunfire near him in Florida.
President Trump is safe following gunshots in his vicinity. That's according to a statement from Trump campaign communications director Stephen Chung. Sources tell ABC News the shooting occurred near Trump International Golf Course in West Palm Beach, Florida. The former president was there at the time, but he was not the target of the shooting. It comes just over 2 months after a gunman opened fire at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania, in which a bullet grazed the former president's ear. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Meantime, a new ABC News Ipsos poll out today on the presidential race. It shows Americans believe Democrat Kamala Harris won over Trump in last week's presidential debate, 52-46%. A major issue at the debate, Trump's false claim that Haitian migrants are stealing and eating dogs in Ohio. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says that's absolutely not true. This is ABC News.
Excited that you were able to get back.
Four crew members are back on Earth after another first for private space flight.
Drogue chutes have successfully deployed.
And it was time for another celebration at SpaceX, the moment the capsule splashed down in the Gulf of Mexico, ending a five-day mission that saw four crew members travel further from Earth, 875 miles, than any astronaut since the Apollo missions. Two crew members, Jared Isaacson and Sarah Gillis, carried out the first-ever civilian spacewalk, almost 460 miles above the Earth's surface. Brian Clark, ABC News.
The man suspected of killing four Idaho college students is getting a change of venue. Brian Koberger transported by plane from the Latah County Jail, where the killings occurred, to Ada County, where his upcoming trial will take place. A judge ruling that change of venue can be in effect. I'm Derek Dennis, ABC News.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com. Your news just for the Superior area. I'm James Kelly with WBZH News.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Sometimes life's challenges leave you feeling alone. We all need someone who understands and listens without judgment. That's what the 988 Wisconsin Lifeline is for. 988 is free and confidential. Trained counselors are ready to listen and provide support 24/7 for mental health and substance use concerns. You can contact 988 for yourself or for someone you know. Don't wait. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988wisconsin.org. 988 24/7. Call, text, chat. Here to support you.
Brought to you by the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
I'm James Kelly with WBZH News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WBZH website at buzzofthenorth.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. You may have heard by now Wisconsin is a battleground state in the presidential campaign that makes it especially important for Wisconsin voters to educate themselves. More from Mike Moan.
University of Wisconsin-Green Bay political scientist David Helpap says if you're approached by a campaign volunteer, ask about the candidate's stances on certain issues. After that encounter, a little homework is encouraged.
If time allows it, do some of your own research to check the facts, to go to news sources, reputable news sources. There are some nonprofit organizations out there that try to provide good, nonpartisan, unbiased information.
Vote411.org is one of those sites that outline a candidate's stances on certain issues, as well as their previous voting and policy record. HelpApp says cross-checking that information with the answers from a campaign staffer can help assess whether that person is worthy of your vote. He also encourages comparing criticisms of rival candidates with the facts to see if they match up. HelpApp says if you have the time, attending a political rally is another valuable way of becoming an informed voter.
And particularly in swing states where we are seeing so many visits by different people, politicians, groups, even celebrities in some cases.
HelpApp says even if you don't agree with a candidate's views, showing up to an event allows you to gain some insight into how other voters feel, possibly making political discourse less hostile. He adds this kind of added exposure is hard to come by in non-swing states. Political experts say these tips are just as important in deciding candidates for state and local offices. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a thunderstorm. Otherwise, mostly sunny and a high of 82. Partly cloudy, 60 tonight, 82 and mostly sunny for Monday. For Tuesday, sunshine and breezy with a high near 81. Remaining above normal for Wednesday with a high near 80.
Right now, it's 82.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday on Up North News Radio, weekend happenings along the Wisconsin campaign trail. And we'll talk about how the Packers did at their home opener at Lambeau Field.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Welcome to this, the second hour of our weekend weekly broadcast on all things government, justice, and law-related. Delighted to have you with me and my terrific producer, Max, here through the wonders of technology in the broadcast studios of Civic Media, inviting you to be a part of our discussion at 844-967-2789. That telephone number once again, inviting your discussion, 844-967-2789. You can also text us and write to us, proposing a question, a comment, an inquiry about things on our syllabus. And in this, the second hour of our broadcast this weekend, tackling two major issues again in the news just this past week. One of them related to a story that we teased at the end of the previous broadcast last weekend, and that is these attempts, these efforts by the U.S. Department of Justice, again announced by our Attorney General Merrick Garland, to attempt to address Russian interference in the 2024 election, talked at that time a bit about the kinds of remedial things that the Department of Justice is doing, including announcing some prosecutions of particular individuals, two specifically, who've been involved in efforts to undermine our elective process, the campaign along the way, and also some other remedies, both inside and outside the Department of Justice, to respond to what has been identified by the FBI, by law enforcement generally, as a renewed attempt by Russian authorities and Russian-adjacent authorities to affect our 2024 election. Just this past week, the State Department, through another member of the cabinet, his name is State Department Chief, if you will, his name is Antony Blinken, and he, of course, in charge of the United States Department of State as the Secretary of State, he announced a similar set of initiatives, actually much related to and coordinated with those of the Department of Justice. These coming from the U.S. Department of State. We'll talk about exactly what Antony Blinken, as our Secretary of State, described just this past week, again, in this whole of government, this all government attempt to push back on Russian interference, the sanctions being imposed, the things being done to affect people who would try to undermine our election, being addressed by the U.S. Department of Justice, announced last week, and again by the U.S. Department of State, announced just this past week. We will describe exactly what it is that those initiatives are all about. But we begin in this, the first segment of our second hour, talking about something else that is going on right now in a federal court in Memphis, and that is the trial of police officers. Memphis police officers charged with the brutal civil rights, the criminal civil rights violation, the death of Tyre Nichols. Tyre Nichols, you may recall from graphic footage of Memphis police officers beating Tyre Nichols, this young FedEx worker roughly 3 minutes in January of 2023, despite cries for help as the officers were beating him, and cry out to his mother at the time, stunning the nation, stunning all of us, and bringing intense scrutiny to the city's law enforcement practices and certainly the conduct in this particular place. Well, what has happened, of course, is that the U.S. Department of Justice, again, under Merrick Garland, under the U.S. attorney there in Memphis, as accomplished by assistant United States attorneys, as accomplished by investigators of the FBI, have put together a prosecution of the officers responsible, allegedly responsible, although some of them have already pled guilty and therefore are adjudicated as felons in these cases. Allegations against all these police officers that their conduct, their behavior at the time of apprehending, stopping Tyre Nichols, chasing him, beating him, causing his death, resulted in a deprivation of his constitutional right. And that constitutional right, of course, is the right to life. And that is a violation of federal law. That's the premise for the charges against these officers who took the life of Tyre Nichols in January of 2023 over a period of just several minutes. What is at stake in this trial that's now underway, jury selection having been completed, opening statements completed, and now the first testimony of justice past week in what will probably be a 3-week trial altogether? We know that prosecutions involving police officers, you recall the names of many of these cases, specifically by the victims of this conduct when it happens. Kind of a mixed array of verdicts, sometimes acquittals, sometimes convictions, at least one mistrial along the way. The three officers in this particular case facing trial, in trial now, their names are Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, and Justin Smith. Remember those names, Bean, Haley, and Smith. If they are convicted on charges of deprivation of rights under color of law, that basically means that they were purportedly acting in the scope of their employment, purporting to use their official capacity, their duties and responsibilities given to them as officers, acting under color of law, but depriving the rights of a citizen, his name once again, Tyre Nichols, depriving him of his right to life. All of them could face up to life in prison. They also face charges related to obstruction of justice and witness tampering. You may recall some of that when all this news was breaking, and those are punishable crimes up to 20 years in prison. The trial now underway, now begun with testimony and opening statements and other materials being presented in court in front of a jury, also presents the first opportunity to answer some quick questions. That's what a trial is in part all about what happened on the evening of January 7th of 2023, including why Nichols was stopped in the first place. Federal prosecutors have just part of this case. We know that all five officers also face various state felony charges, including second-degree murder. Their specialized police unit has been disbanded, and the Justice Department is also investigating, separate from this criminal prosecution, also investigating the agency's policing practices. That's also a part of the routine mission of the Department of Justice. When you've identified certainly a specific incident like this that is horrific and condemnable, but also a more systemic problem inside a police unit, the Department of Justice also now looking at that. Mr. Nichols' family has also filed a multi-million dollar lawsuit against the city and the police department, continuing to push for changes to policing practices in Memphis. The city, however, remains in a standoff with the state legislature over some policing and gun safety changes that it was hoping to make. So what do we know? What do we know about this case? Let's do some recollection of what is in the public domain, obviously presented in greater detail during the course of the trial just begun this past week and continuing at least for two more weeks. Much of what is known, I've already indicated, is based upon this police footage taken from body cameras and some surveillance video of this fatal encounter between Tyre Nichols and police at that time. The footage begins, you may recall, as a traffic stop. It's already underway. And police officers are apparently seen at that time yelling with their guns raised. They approach Nichols' car. They open his door. They pull him out of the vehicle. And Nichols is heard saying, "I didn't do anything." He drops to the ground. Again, all this according to the video, the body cameras on his side, and officers surround him. He appears not to resist. in that video, which again will be a significant portion of the trial. Though he struggles, apparently, as the officers do hold parts of his body down and threaten him. Nichols is pepper sprayed. He's pepper sprayed. Officers fire a stun gun at him as he stands up and he runs. He runs away. And the video then shows that 8 minutes later, after he's been pursued into a suburban neighborhood, officers there are severely beating him fairly close to his mother's home. This happens again after the initial stop on the street. They're seen kicking him in the head while he's on the ground and pulling him back up as another officer uses a baton, an extendable baton, again on the video, to hit him multiple times. Nichols does not appear to be fighting back at that time throughout this beating, and it ends with his falling to the ground. More officers, again, according to the video, which is going to be shown in the trial here, arrive on the scene moments later, and Nichols is not receiving any medical attention then for several minutes. Also, a major portion of the presentation by the prosecution in this case to show this indifference and more than that, the criminal behavior with respect to the constitutional rights of Tyre Nichols. An autopsy after all this happens declared his death on January 10th, 3 days later, to be a homicide. From what? From blunt force injuries to his head. It's still a bit unclear about exactly why the officers stopped Nichols on the drive home. And police officers at the time that this was all breaking walked back some initial preliminary claims that it was for reckless driving. Now, who are the officers who are on trial? Again, Haley was among the officers who first dropped Nichols and pulled him from the car with an expletive-laden order directing him to get out. After Nichols broke away and ran toward his mother's home, Smith and Bean chased and tackled him. Those are the allegations against them. In particular, video shows the men, again, repeatedly striking Nichols in the head. After Haley arrived, some street surveillance video also shows his turning on his phone flashlight and snapping some pictures of Nichols, who is at that time bloody and slumped against the car. Two former officers who participated in the beating initially pleaded not guilty to the charges brought by the U.S. Department of Justice, but changed their pleas after striking an agreement with the federal prosecutors. One officer, Desmond Mills, pleaded guilty to two felony charges of obstruction of justice and excessive force. That happened way back in November. And prosecutors are recommending a 15-year prison sentence as to him. Months later, a second officer, his name is Emmett Martin, he pleaded guilty to one count of deprivation of rights under color of law. Again, the charge against the remaining officers here. He participated in and allowed for the unlawful assault on Mr. Nichols at that time. Those are part of the allegations against him. Another count related to conspiracy and witness tampering. After he discussed with the other officers the possibility of lying, downplaying what happened to his superiors, prosecutors said they would recommend a 40-year prison sentence for Mr. Martin. We know, of course, as this case goes to trial, that lots of the documents related to this, which have not been a part of the public domain, will be presented. Obviously, these videos of various kinds will also be shown to the jury. The judge, the federal judge, his name is Mark Morris, has read more than three dozen names from a list of potential witnesses, including Martin and Mills, both of them plainly going to testify as a part of their cooperation agreement. Also includes a person named Preston Hempel, a former police officer, and others who are also a part of this as we continue our discussion of exactly what we anticipate happening in this trial of the officers responsible, allegedly responsible, for the violation of due process rights, constitutional rights, of Tyre Nichols in that federal courthouse in Memphis, as we continue our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Up North News Radio.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
The
The Todd Alba Show.
Going back to this interview we just had, again, many thanks to Michael Cohen, former attorney and fixer for Donald Trump. Let's go back to the phone lines. Don in Milwaukee. Don, thanks for holding. What say you?
My God, Ted, I've been listening to your station, Civic Media, for a long time, and this was a blockbuster. I was absolutely riveted.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about this all-important civil rights trial, this criminal civil rights trial that's pending right now in federal court in Memphis against the remaining defendants, the remaining police officers of the Memphis Police Department charged with depriving Tyre Nichols of his life. Talking a bit about what has happened in this case, what we know, plenty more details coming out during the course of the trial in the next couple of weeks, but also getting some sense from the judge who has talked as a part of the selection of the jury about the likely witnesses coming up in this case. And then once again, those include two of the now convicted police officers, their names Martin and Mills. They are, according to the witness list, going to testify in favor of the prosecution's case, supporting the notion that there indeed was a violation of constitutional rights here in the brutal murder and death of Tyre Nichols. And also indicating along the way, that is Judge Morris, that another person, Preston Hemphill, he's a former Memphis police officer. He was the one who shot his stun gun at Tyre Nichols as he ran away from the police. There's another person named Dwayne Smith. He's the supervising lieutenant who arrived at the scene after the beating. Both Hemphill and Smith are no longer in the police force. Hemphill has been fired. Smith is retired, though probably both of them would have been fired on their own right, if you will. Neither one of those was charged in the case. Judge Norris, as a part of this obviously high publicity case, taking some very painstaking, appropriate efforts to ensure that the jury is selected properly and emphasizing impartiality, as judges and justices should do. At one point, he asked some of the prospective jurors to consider the characteristics of a good juror. What a great civics lesson this is in the midst of this terrible, terrible prosecution in the wake of this terrible, terrible crime. He talked about how to handle bias. And perhaps most notably, could they be impartial after viewing video that showed police using force? He said, think about the unique situation you're in. This is Judge Norris. Your decision in the end must be unanimous. It must be based on what you hear. Again, describing the focus of jurors on what they hear in the courtroom and not in what is out there in the public domain in the media. On Tuesdays, federal prosecutor and defense lawyers for the three former officers did in fact select together the dozen jurors and four alternates, all of them from a group of about 50 people. And again, the judge impaneling a jury early in this week, Wednesday opening statements made, and now the trial itself underway. We know that in the wake of the initiating statements here, a little bit more about what the government's case is going to be and a bit more about what the defense case will likely be as this goes forward. The former officers, again, standing trial, they're accused of federal criminal civil rights violations. Assistant U.S. Attorney Elizabeth Rogers, she's the one actually prosecuting this case on behalf of the Department of Justice. She said during opening statements on Wednesday that the officers were punishing Nichols for fleeing a traffic stop. That a part of the narrative account that I just provided. And she used this stunningly horrific term, this phrase. She said the term is a run tax, a police slang for disciplining a subject who tries to escape. Indicating, of course, a huge amount of behavioral and certainly linguistic corruption inside the police entity, the police agency itself. If, in fact, you're taxing that tax, what is it, being in the nature of a beating? If you run from police, a run tax, she said, which was commonplace inside the police department, according to what the Department of Justice has said, plainly that kind of thing going to be the focus of the pattern or practice investigation the more systemic look that's being undertaken by the Department of Justice right now, if in fact that was a part of the routine of officers, even if it's not codified in a book, in policies, that kind of practice is the sort of thing that plainly is in violation of the Constitution that had to stop. The assistant U.S. attorney, in addition to alerting the jury and alerting all of us to the kind of language that they're going to hear in the course of this prosecution, said the force that they used with respect to Nichols did not match his actions. She warned jurors, again, as did the judge, that they're going to be seeing some videos of the beating. They're going to be horrific, horrific to watch, including some that were publicly released weeks after Nichols himself had died. Officers pummeled Tyree Nichols, she said, because of this run tax. She also said that officers just stood around during the crucial minutes when Nichols' heart stopped, when they could have helped him, arguably could have saved his life. She also went on to say during the course of her opening statement, you won't see Tyree Nichols pose a threat to these officers at any time. Those are significant words. And of course, the government making those commitments about the proof that it will present during the course of its trial in this matter. Now, attorneys for the three who are continuing to trial began crafting their defense as well on behalf of their defendants, their clients, which is the obligation that they have as attorneys, the right of every defendant to testify if he or she chooses to do it. Most importantly, the right to present a defense if he or she chooses to do so. That also a part of our basic system of justice in America. Bean's lawyer said during his opening statement that Nichols drove 2 miles after the officers put their blue lights on to stop him, and that he did not comply with the orders given to him to raise his hands and was, according to the attorney, fighting like hell. The attorney also said that some Sky Cop camera video will show that Nichols was acting suspiciously and that evidence would also show that the officers are not guilty of the offense conduct that's charged by the government in this case. The narrative you hear here will take you 5 minutes to deliberate on, counsel said. Went on to describe other circumstances that will be presented during the course of the trial. And all of that, again, according to the counsel for the defendants, going to lead to an acquittal here, a finding by the jury that these particular defendants are not guilty of the offense conduct set forth in the indictment against them. Rogers, on the other hand, again, during the course of her opening statement, said all of these defendants stood by his dying body and they laughed. She said that the officers were angry again that Nichols fled. The pepper spray they used during the traffic stop had affected them too. They talked about hitting Nichols with so many pieces and straight haymakers, which is slang for punches. All that, again, according to the prosecutor here, Ms. Rogers, describing what the testimony is going to show during the course of the trial. All of that, a part of the presentation going forward now as a court in the regular course of the conduct of the trial inside, of course, the courtroom. That is what will be happening in the next couple of weeks. We also know as well that there are things going on outside the courtroom as well. The city, as a part of its effort to try to address these policy problems that led to Tyree Nichols' death, the kinds of things that are being presented in the courthouse, trying to adopt a larger approach to remedying this kind of thing. And they're involved in a standoff right now with some state leaders in the state house over its policing and public safety policies, attempting to change those. There's this dispute between lawmakers who've threatened to escalate this entire dispute between what should and should not happen to remedy the problems here by stripping the city of a share of its state sales tax revenue. It's basically saying if you do these kinds of things to remedy these police problems and policies, we'll take away your share of state sales taxes. And again, it's reigniting, undeniably, not only that dispute, but also a debate generally about police tactics and the brutal treatment of certain individuals by law enforcement. At a moment, again, when cities and states across the country are looking, as they continue to do, at police practices. Now, police practices around the country designed for the purpose of doing what? For ensuring safety and security of all people. That's what they're designed to do. That's why they're put in place. That's why there is training. When I was U.S. attorney, we did a huge amount of training, not only to federal officers, but also state officers. All of that also a part of the response.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Matt and Air on Air.
ABC News. I'm Derek Dennis. Another shooting scare for former President Trump. Gunfire near him in Florida.
President Trump is safe following gunshots in his vicinity. That's according to a statement from Trump campaign communications director Stephen Chung. Sources tell ABC News the shooting occurred near Trump International Golf Course in West Palm Beach, Florida. The former president was there at the time, but he was not the target of the shooting. It comes just over 2 months after a gunman opened fire at a Trump rally in Pennsylvania, in which a bullet grazed the former president's ear. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
Meantime, a new ABC News Ipsos poll out today on the presidential race. It shows Americans believe Democrat Kamala Harris won over Trump in last week's presidential debate, 52-46%. A major issue at the debate, Trump's false claim that Haitian migrants are stealing and eating dogs in Ohio. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine says that's absolutely not true. This is ABC News.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
The Packers march on. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with sports, filling in for Mike Clemens. The Green Bay Packers will start Malik Willis today in place of the injured Jordan Love, who was listed as doubtful for today's game against the Colts with an MCL sprain. The Packers elevated Sean Clifford from the practice squad to the active roster yesterday to serve as a backup. Willis says he has been preparing and knows he needs to be ready at any given moment to contribute.
I'm just trying to put in as much time as I need to feel comfortable and just make sure that whenever my number is called, I'm ready. Whether Jordan can go or he can't, you know, just try to be ready.
The Packers and Colts kick off at noon. Yesterday, it was Alabama blowing out Wisconsin 42-10 in college football. Wisconsin has a week off before playing at number 11 USC on September 28th. It was a wild night in Arizona as the Brewers piled up 15 runs in a 15-8 win over the Diamondbacks. The win reduced the Brewers' magic number to 3. Same two teams, Brewers and Diamondbacks, will play again this afternoon. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Civic Media Sports.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, slight chance of a thunderstorm. Otherwise, mostly sunny and a high of 82. Partly cloudy, 60 tonight, 82 and mostly sunny for Monday. For Tuesday, sunshine and breezy with a high near 81. Remaining above normal for Wednesday with a high near 80.
Right now, it's 82.
Travel back in time and experience the magic of the Minnesota Renaissance Festival. Journey through a world of armored knights, joking jesters, and enchanting fair maidens. Every weekend, August 17th through September 29th, thrill to live combat jousting, feasting on turkey legs, and shopping hundreds of unique artisans. Bring the whole family for unforgettable fun. Get your discounted tickets today at renaissancefest.com. Find your magic at the Minnesota Renaissance Festival.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west, northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Dom Salvia Show.
Thank you for tuning in. Got my friend Earl Ingram Jr., Civic Media's own. Earl, thanks for joining me and hanging out in Waukesha, man.
Man, you sound like you've done this before.
It's been a couple of times. I mean, not as old as veteran as you, perhaps, Earl.
The first time you're doing this under the Dominic Salvia Show, you've invited me. It's an honor.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. Dom Salvia.
Next time, join me as we start the new week barely towards the presidential election. We'll have a week full of special guests, celebrity hosts, and you. Tune in.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are continuing our discussion here in Amicus Law Review of this brutal beating death of Tyre Nichols and the attempt by the United States Department of Justice to accomplish some justice when it comes to holding responsible the people for Tyre Nichols' death in January of 2023. Along the way, Nichols' stepfather, named Rodney Wills, has said, "We'll never fully heal, but justice for Tyre is a step in the right direction." Other people have said that in addition to the criminal prosecution, whatever its result, the city also has to heal and has to work on policies and changes internal to the police, internal to the community. And indeed, there are people inside the official ranks there in Memphis who want to accomplish just that. You have got a representative named Justin Pearson. He represents Memphis and Shelby County in the Tennessee legislature. And he says it is not impossible for us to have police officers who are focused on protection and on safety and not have the death of people at the hands of police. You can do both of those things, he's basically saying. And in the 20 months since Tyre Nichols' death, some of the leaders in opposition to Pearson and others have repeatedly maligned the newly elected DA and others in the Memphis area for failing to address the scope of other crime issues and overstepping, they have said, their legal boundaries in this particular prosecution. The city, for itself and legislatively and other venues, has included proposals for change to the city charter to require the safe storage of firearms, handgun permits, to ban assault rifles, allow law enforcement to temporarily confiscate firearms from people a court deems to be a threat to themselves or others. Those are the so-called red flags or ERPO laws, all kinds of things that the city and state legislators have attempted to do to address the issue of crime in Memphis. Nonetheless, attacks by individuals inside the legislature continue, according to Pearson, to make it impossible for the city to change, according to him. He says, if you have the state legislature and the executive branch gung-ho, he said, about refusing to do anything to help you reduce crime, refusing to do anything to help you with this epidemic that is plaguing you, it is really hard to make progress for a city. Now, more generally, we know that Memphis has struggled for a long time, like other major cities in America, with high amounts of crime and systemic oppression of residents of color, nearly a quarter of whom in Memphis are living in poverty. There were at least 1,038 fatal shootings in Memphis between 2020 and 2023, according to some reliable analysis, compared with at least 400 in Nashville, the only Tennessee city with more residents. Just over half of Memphis's 633,000 residents lived near a shooting. And although there have been changes along the way to address not only the crime situation, but also to accomplish remedies for policing and make people safe and secure without accomplishing violations of constitutional rights, many people have bemoaned the slow progress. And that includes Kermit Moore. He's the president of the Memphis branch of the NAACP. He said, "I think there may have been some small incremental changes, but there is a lot more to do. The citizens of Memphis," he said, "are ready to get these trials behind us so our city can heal." So the city can heal in all of this. That will certainly take a lot of work, a lot of effort. The trial is one aspect of that, not only for the family, but for the community generally, for the state, for all of our nation, as we think once again about the appropriate role of law enforcement keeping us safe and secure, absolutely critical to the safety and security of our communities, that we do have responsible, reliable, competent, and experienced law enforcement officers keeping us in the ways that we should be kept safe and secure. We also need to ensure that as they do that, that their own behaviors are not violative of our constitution, state constitutions, federal constitutions, and our fundamental beliefs about human rights and civil rights in America. That's what the case is about. That's what the attempt to accomplish legislative change is about. And that is also what is all animating the attempt by the U.S. Department of Justice to look at the policies and practices generally of the police in Memphis, Tennessee. We're going to look at that and monitor those situations in the times ahead in Memphis and plainly in other cities around our nation. As always, we thank you for comments and questions, inquiries about our syllabus here on Amicus Law Review. And that includes comments from Mark. Mark calling in this morning. Mark, appreciate your inquiry or your observation about our subject matters this morning.
You brought up Fisher again. I couldn't help, you know, the history lesson that we have there is that rebellions have been going on even before the Republic was established under the Constitution. I just reviewed it this morning, that Shays' rebellion had to be suppressed by the states because the Articles of Confederation didn't cover the federal government actually being able to fund the troops to put down that rebellion. And the Whiskey Rebellion, I think, was 1794 that Washington actually had to put down. You know, that was another rebellion because over taxes, they're protesting against the tax. But for a Supreme Court to engage in the sophistry of Fisher, to allow people who were involved in an insurrection against the United States, is just beyond me. And the insurrection continues, I think, in some ways. That part of it started out with Donald Trump's, you know, denial of that he lost the election. And even prior to the election, they had plans in place to, you know, to negate the election and overturn the results of it. And we have members of the Supreme Court who actually gave aid and comfort to the insurrectionists by, you know, Samuel Alito flying his flag upside down, perhaps Clarence Thomas in a more innocuous way, but giving aid and comfort to the insurrectionists. And these people were engaged in, they broke through the barricades to break into the Capitol. They should have known they were doing, they're breaking the law when they did that. And for Donald Trump to stir this on and continues to stir this on, still continuing to deny the fact that he lost the election in 2020. And there's hundreds of, you know, official Republican officials across this country who still deny, still claim absolutely that all the election was stolen and all this.
Even just as late as this past week,
that
right?
That is,
yeah, go ahead.
I would maintain that that is in support of the insurrection. That is in support against the Constitution of the United States, because if you deny or abridge in any way, you know, the right of people to vote, which I maintain actually involves counting those votes and making those votes count, rather than the more or less, perhaps I'm being unjust here, but the Stalinistic practice of them wanting to count the votes after the fact and say no. And we have states across the country now say, well, if you don't like the results, we're going to toss them out.
Right, right. And Mark, you talk about, for example, the involvement of the Supreme Court in that, in this Fisher case. And let me pluck from your good comments and thoughts here just that, a little follow-up on that. Amy Coney Barrett agrees with you. She was one of the Supreme Court justices who did not concur in this decision on Fisher, as we have talked about before. She basically said, what are you talking about? I'm looking at this statute, 1512. It basically prohibits engaging in conspiratorial conduct to undermine to obstruct an official proceeding. And she says, let's talk about what Mr. Fisher did. He plainly did just that. She says, what is the issue? Why is this so difficult? She talks about the Supreme Court engaging in backflips. That's her language, not mine, to try to accomplish this sophistry that, as you've described it, and accomplishing this end that prohibits the government from using this statute to prosecute people who've engaged in this attempt to obstruct an official proceeding. And so you find a good company. You do, Mark, as do many others, including me, in the language of Amy Coney Barrett, again, joining the dissenters in Fisher, who said, no, the majority is just wrong in interpreting that statute as it has done. Nonetheless, it is the law. Interestingly, of course, it's also one of the statutes under which Donald Trump continues to be prosecuted in that superseding indictment. Jack Smith has said, no problem under the guidelines set forth by the Supreme Court in that Fisher case. He said, I can show you that Donald Trump also engaged in document-related offenses, presumably voting, ballots, those kinds of things, counting votes both in the Capitol and other places around the country. But the 1512, the Fisher issue, does not go away, also again in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan, as she resolves many issues given to her by the Supreme Court recently. Lots and lots of things going on in all these cases. Mark, appreciate your observations this weekend on our broadcast. Finally, we want to spend some time talking about the election itself and a story that I began to chat about a bit in the final moments of our previous broadcast, and that is these announcements of plans by the United States Department of Justice, Department of State, more recently, to counter Russian influence ahead of the 2024 election going on right now. You may recall well from my brief recitation of the headline, if you will, from about a week or so ago, that Merrick Garland had announced this broad effort to push back on these Russian influence campaigns in the present campaign, in the present election. As the Department of Justice tries to curb the Kremlin's use of state-run media and other entities who are promoting fake news to sway American voters. Sound familiar? It's happening again. According to the Attorney General, according to the FBI, according to Department of Justice officials looking at all this, the actions that were announced a little over a week ago by the Attorney General include things like sanctions and indictments, seizing of web domains that U.S. officials, including the FBI, say the Kremlin affirmatively is using to spread propaganda and disinformation in this campaign about Ukraine, which Russia, of course, as you know well, invaded more than 2 years ago. Merrick Garland detailing these actions taken by the Justice Department. They include, again, the indictment, the charges through the grand jury process of two Russian employees of RT. RT, that's the company, the name you probably have heard about, not only from our previous broadcast, but in other invocations of it. That's the state-owned broadcaster. They apparently used a company in Tennessee to spread some of this malicious, unfounded content. And the takedown of a Russian malign influence campaign known as Doppelganger, all that announced by the Attorney General a little over a week or so ago. The American people, Attorney General Garland said, are entitled to know when a foreign power engages in political activities or seeks to influence public discourse. The Treasury Department also, at the same time, is imposing sanctions on a thing called ANO Dialogue. ANO Dialogue, it's a Russian nonprofit that helps run the Doppelganger network, as well as the editor-in-chief of RT. Her name is Margarita Samoyan, and her deputies. The Department of State has also offered a $10 million reward for information pertaining to foreign interference in American election processes. The department specifically said it was seeking information on a group known as the Russian Angry Hackers Did It, or RADIT. State Department also said it would designate five state-funded news outlets, including RT, a thing called Rupli, and Sputnik, as foreign government missions and restrict the issuance of visas to people working for those Kremlin-supported media institutions. Now, all of that coming out of the Attorney General's announcements of last week. He said the investigation is ongoing, anticipating even more action, more charges, more investigative, more sanctioning kinds of things being done. The Justice Department and the FBI have also investigating a handful of Americans accused of knowingly spreading some of these false Kremlin narratives. Again, all this according to the Attorney General. Officials have emphasized, of course, they're not trying to curb free speech under the First Amendment. Americans who merely repeat or spread stories, the Attorney General said, that they see on Russian state media are not being investigated as part of these efforts. But they said the officials involving RT have spread disinformation, and they've done that through bots and other means. And they're looking, that is the Department of Justice is, more closely at how the Kremlin and its spy agencies are influencing those processes and influencing the election. Those indictments of those two Russian employees with conspiracy to violate the Foreign Agents Registration Act, those are proceeding. The prosecutions against those two, accused of spending about $10 million to secretly pay the unnamed Tennessee company to spread some 2,000 English language videos on YouTube, on TikTok, on Instagram, and on X. No small undertaking of that at all. Garland saying that the videos are often consistent with Russia's interest in amplifying U.S. domestic divisions in order to do what, he said, to weaken U.S. opposition to core Russian interests, particularly when it comes to this war in Ukraine. The Tennessee company, he said, has never disclosed its ties to the Russian government. Now, all this is a lot. It's a lot to take in. It is a lot to consume. But after the announcements of some of these kinds of things, you also have contemporary statements by some of the officials on the Russian end, a Russian advisor saying that they're proudly doing these kinds of things. When we come back, we'll talk more about the response to all of this from Russia and those individuals here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. We hear a lot about financial literacy. So what is it? Well, financial literacy is not learning how to pick stocks in the stock market. Financial literacy is learning how to create a budget, how to track personal spending, how to manage and get out of debt, and how to reasonably plan for retirement. And get this, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin offers one-on-one financial coaching to any Badger State resident. It's free, it's confidential, and you can do it in person, by phone, or even online. Just search online for UW Extension Financial Coach, and you can get to a sign-up form. I haven't used the program myself yet, but the stats they've posted show a lot of people getting a lot of help. For more money tips, check out workmoney.org. Till next time, I'm Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, WBZH, Hayward's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review in our final time together on this weekend broadcast, talking about these efforts by the U.S. Department of Justice, Department of State as well, to attempt to push back on Russian interference in our present campaign. Obviously, news of all these things being done by the Department of Justice, Department of State, Department of Treasury as well, getting a response from the Kremlin spy agencies and representatives of RT, which is the target of some of these efforts. One of the indictments, again, prompts RT to post what can only be viewed as a sarcastic response, rather, on its website from a woman named Anna Belkina, deputy editor-in-chief. She says, there are three certainties in life, she says, death, taxes, and she says again sarcastically, the RT's interference in American elections. And she says, we're not idiots as we go forward and doing what we do, plainly being quite brazen about exactly what is happening here in the course of they're attempting to undermine our campaign and our election process. Christopher Wray, who is the FBI director, as you know, said the fake news sites have been seized by the government. He said, when we learn that adversaries overseas are trying to hide who they are and where their propaganda is coming from, again, this according to Christopher Wray, as a part of campaigns to deliberately sow discord, we, the FBI, are going to continue to do everything we can to expose their hidden hand and disrupt their efforts. All of this as a part of what the FBI inside the Department of Justice is doing. Joined this past week, reaffirming much of what the Attorney General and others said just last week, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, also much in the news this past week, once again accusing Russian TV networks of conducting covert intelligence acts inside and attempting to affect the United States of America. The United States, Canada, and Britain just late this past week accused Russia's global television network, RT, once again, of acting as an arm of that country's intelligence agencies. This according to Antony Blinken and others. He appeared at the State Department and said that RT is no longer acting simply as a state-owned news organization, now actively carrying out overt operations in the United States and other places, reaffirming what the Attorney General said a week ago. Blinken went on to say this. He said, today we're exposing how Russia deploys similar tactics around the world, Russian weaponization of disinformation to subvert and polarize free and open societies extends to every part of the world. This again, according to Antony Blinken, just this past week. And so he went on to say this. He said, we urge every ally, every partner to start by treating RT's activities as they do other intelligence activities by Russia within their borders. U.S. intelligence officials have said that the Kremlin is seeking to bolster former President Donald Trump's campaign, angered, they said, by the Biden administration's support for Ukraine. The announcement by the Secretary of State, previous to that, the announcement by the Attorney General, meant to spotlight RT's global activities and similar efforts, again, around the world to try to track what RT and others are doing. The coordinator of the State Department's Global Engagement Center, his name is James Rubin, said this. He said, we're exposing what they do in country after country around the world. His entity focuses on foreign propaganda and disinformation efforts. And, of course, beyond that, all of these agencies, the Justice Department, the State Department, the FBI, Pentagon's Cyber National Mission Force, has also entered this fray, accusing an editor of RT of working as a spy, an officer to oversee the creation of hundreds of fake accounts on X, formerly Twitter, that spread the network's content. Now, much of this, again, is a part of a coordinated effort, according to the Attorney General and according to the Secretary of State and others inside the Treasury Department to influence our election in 2024 and beyond. The goal, the stated goal, including Canada and Britain as allies, they've made simultaneous announcements warning about RT's covert activities here in the United States. That also following the imposition of sanctions in those nations as well. Transactions conducted in dollars could now be subject to freezing or seizing by the Treasury those transactions engaged in by RT. The goal, the articulated goal of the sanctions, the diplomacy, the prosecutions, these indictments, is to alert countries where RT remains a popular source of global news. And that includes, according to the Attorney General, according to the Secretary of State, many parts of Africa and the Middle East and of South America, all of them being called upon to alert populations of the potential for Russian influence campaigns against their governments as well that fall out of the Kremlin's favor. Antony Blinken once again talking about just this broad influence. He said this: "We will not stand by as RT and other actors carry out covert activities in support of Russia's nefarious activities, and will continue to respond forcefully to what he called Moscow's playbook of aggression and subversion, one that includes involving invading foreign nations, fomenting coups, weaponizing corruption, carrying out assassinations, meddling in elections, and unjustly detaining foreign nationals." That is a stunning oral verbal indictment of the behaviors. Last year alone, this same entity, the State Department's Global Engagement Center, disclosed one of these, a covert information operation to push Kremlin-friendly content in Central and South America. Thus, the reason why much of this being articulated into foreign nations as well. According to the Global Engagement Center, they're producing articles that appear to originate with local media organizations, not the Russian government, even though plainly the Russian government and RT, other entities like that, the source of all this information. That campaign, according to the Secretary of State, according to the Department of Justice, involved two companies, the Social Design Agency and a thing called Structura. And they were cited in these indictments just disclosed last week against these two individuals. Both of those companies, according to the Attorney General, according to the Secretary of State, according to other government officials, report to a former prime minister in Russia who is now a senior advisor to President Vladimir Putin of Russia. All of that being announced by the U.S. Department of Justice, being announced by the U.S. Department of State as a part of this overall effort to address Russian interference. And we have seen this, of course, in the past. We know well that in the wake of the and during the midst of the so-called Mueller investigation of Russian interference in the previous election, 2016, we know as well that as he conducted his investigation of that period of time, also involving allegations of obstruction of justice, that many of these same kinds of things surface, that is the involvement of Russia, foreign entities in our elections. As Amicus Law Review continues in future broadcasts, we'll continue to monitor this and other stories in the
Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Andra Watkins returns. She grew up in a Christian nationalist household and can tell us how that relates to Project 2025. It's not good. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
This is the story of the one. As a warehouse manager, her job is to transform chaos into clarity and to see patterns where others see problems. Luckily, she's got a partner who shares her perspective. Grainger offers over a million industrial-grade products,
backed by real person support and in-depth online resources, so she can tackle every task with precision and turn potential setbacks into streamlined success. Call clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.